All right, this is the Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my able co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Jay. How are you doing on your birthday?
Oh, I'm doing just fine.
Happy birthday to you, my friend.
You know, I have to say, Jay, I'm really impressed at how sprightly you are for a guy who just hit 60.
Jeff, let's not start this off on the wrong foot. Listeners, I want to put a quick shout out to the listeners here. If you want to make Jay Caruso very happy on his birthday, you want to give him a great gift, why don't you visit us on iTunes or wherever you listen to this fine podcast and give us a rating. 5 stars, preferably. 4 will do. But we do appreciate it very much.
Leave a written review too. Tell them, you know, you really like Jay's voice. You don't like Neil's all that much. And Mike Rowe has the best voice of anybody.
Yes. Yes, he does. But maybe we can trade on some of that glory. Just give us a 4 or 5.
Just give a 4 or 5 rating. And that's all we're asking for. So we're
And anybody who offers a fantastical mythical review of the first Jeff Blahar show on this podcast, that would be very appreciated. It's one you've never heard, but it was excellent.
Which brings us to our guest for this episode, who has very adroitly introduced himself, Mr. Jeff Blair.
Yes,
is with us again. We had Jeff on once before, did we not, Jay?
We did, and it was a lost episode. It was a technical thing, and partially my fault for not securing the backup of the original file, and it was a great conversation, and the whole damn thing was just lost completely, and no one could figure it out. It was kind of like Bermuda Triangle, you know, it just disappeared and no one could explain it.
Isn't that sort of just the nature of life, though? These wonderful things happen and then they're gone, and then you can never get them back no matter how hard you try.
I know, it's terrible.
Stolen moments. It's like looking at photographs in a photo album. It's like you'll never get that actual experience back again.
Exactly.
Alas.
Speaking of things that will never be as good as they once were, I think our topic tonight is the Republican Party, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, you've gotten very adept at this, Neil, I have to say. Yes. Yes.
I believe
we're talking about the end of all things. This is the scene in Mordor at the end of Return of the King, if you're a fan of Tolkien, where Mount Doom is erupting, the lava flows are everywhere, the world is ending, except this time there are no magical eagles to fly the Republican Party to safety. We're all going to die.
And if you have half a brain, you're asking yourself, why didn't they just take the eagles all the way there in the first place? It would have avoided all of the present difficulties, which is another question you can ask about the Republican Party. Why didn't we just do this at this point and avoid where we are now? So
Jay, the eagles at this point would have been, you know, a year ago when Trump was first saying he wanted to run and was threatening with, you know, if they're not fair to me, then I'm running third party. When Reince Priebus should have said, go ahead and run third party, get out of here. That should have been his response. Not, you know, let's make sure that the first question that they ask at a debate is whether or not every candidate's going to vote. And the moment he didn't put up his hand is another moment that they should have said, you're done. Should have done everything they could. You know, they should have done the Debbie Wasserman Schultz thing and tried to do what they could to keep him out of there, even if they found out about it later through hacked emails.
I'll take it
further back,
Jay. At
least the DNC tried.
They never should have invited him to CPAC to speak and legitimized him in the eyes of many of the so-called conservative base. They never should have.
The moment he went birther back in 2011 is when they should have excommunicated.
Nobody ever should have stood next to him. Mitt Romney shouldn't have stood next to him in 2012. But, you know, take it even further back than that. Maybe the conservative movement should never have tried to secretly court racists to bolster their electoral numbers. I don't know. There's a lot of things that we start to question when we look at the present state of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And if we go too far down the rabbit hole, I will get exceedingly grim.
Right. So let's now. Well, let's
not get into who started courting racists when. All right. I will actually point out that I everybody makes fun of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and apparently she was a terrible executive. But I agree with you guys. If Reince Priebus had been one iota more ruthless and cunning and willing to expel a foreign invader from the Republican Party as Debbie Wasserman Schultz was willing to treat Bernie Sanders, we might not be in this situation now.
Yeah. I agree. They you know, everyone wants to sit there and talk about, but they are ruthless players in this game. And it's something, you know, Republicans used to be like until they wanted to, you know, I mean, I can understand it's like one thing for a general election, but in the primary, who cares? It's a war, and do whatever you can. It's a dirty fight. It's not clean. And if you have to fight dirty, then fight dirty. So what?
They got the job done and we didn't.
Exactly. Exactly. And he, you know, Trump can talk around, walk around talking about rigged systems all the time, but you know he benefited from the rigged system, and they didn't you know, they could have fixed it, but they didn't, you know. So, but really the question here is, and you know, because we're gonna, you know, we don't want to discuss this entire thing for the, you know, this for the entire hour, so really let's just try and see what we can come up with here in this discussion between us three, in the sense that let's assume a Fox poll just came out, released a little while ago, Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton is up by 10 points over Donald Trump in this latest Fox News poll, 49-39, which is not good. This is Fox News. It's a Fox News poll, and he's still down by 10. So let's talk about this under the assumption that Trump is going to lose in November. Where does the party go after this is all said and done?
To the grave, I hope.
Always opening on a bright note.
Yeah, Neil Dewey. Neil's always the opposite.
I'm not pleased. I'm exceedingly displeased, in fact. I'm actively hateful towards the Republican Party, which I have voted for in every election of my adult life. I've never been tempted to vote for a Democrat. Ever. And yet here I stand looking at the Republican Party nominating essentially a proto-fascist, a baby fascist. And where does it go after it nominates a fascist? It either doubles down on the fascism or it recovers its soul. How does it do that? I don't know.
Well, that's an interesting point. And Jeff, let me ask you about that. I mean, people are saying that if Trump loses and then there's another 4 years of the perception, I'm not going to say the reality, the perception that the GOP is, quote unquote, giving Hillary everything that she wants, which is a common refrain that some of these people say about Barack Obama and the GOP, which is complete nonsense. But if they do that, isn't there the possibility, like Neil is saying, that there's actually somebody worse than Donald Trump that comes along in 2019?
Well, it's so hard to look down that far down the road and say, well, yeah, somebody else could come along. In 2012, Donald Trump, while not exactly predictable, was plausible, all right? We saw what kind of trouble that Mitt Romney had wrapping up the nomination. If you remember, all these, like, goofy pretenders kept on popping up like whack-a-moles, to try to take him on. They became the sort of temporary repositories of distrust with the establishment, whether it was Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum or whatever it was. Trump, to my mind, is sort of the logical outcome of that. And so, yeah, that's going to quite possibly happen again. On the other hand, this is a point that Eric Erickson made today, and I thought it was a really good one. I've kind of returned to it over and over as the day has gone on, which is that, you know, it's almost a better thing if Trump doesn't drop out than if he does drop out. Because if Trump drops out, which isn't going to happen, but let's just say that he did, we'd probably still lose the race at this point anyway, and we wouldn't have any potential to even claim some sort of exorcism of Trumpism. We wouldn't be able to say, all right, we gave you your candidate, and look at how he did. If he leaves, no, it's all going to be, you know, relitigated in 2020. Meanwhile, what at least we can hope for, I mean, this is the best case scenario, and it is not a happy case. This is a very bleak argument. So I know Neil will like it. The bleak argument I'm going to make here, the best case scenario is that we go in with Trump, we get absolutely murdered with down ticket massacres all across the country. And not only does Trump go, and you know he becomes yesterday's news, but also a lot of the Republican Party elites who made their bet with him, rather than get together and put together a plan to stop him or to find some other acceptable alternative, I want them to go too. When Neil says he's disgusted with the Republican Party, I take what he says there to mean the same thing that I feel, which is that I'm not just disgusted with Trump or even with the voters that put Trump in the office. I'm disgusted with the elites that said, all right, this is fine. This is fine, like the stupid meme that we see on Twitter. This is okay. I can deal with this. As you're sitting there in a burning house in hell and melting, I want the Reince Priebuses, the establishment types, the DC types, the congressmen who went along to get along. I even look at people who I admire, like Paul Ryan, and I do like him a lot. And I look at the agony he's in right now as Trump has basically knifed him in the back in his primary. And I just say, you know what? We need a better caliber of leader. We need people who realize, just as people realized in a different context in the 1930s, that you have to stand up to these sorts of psychopathic bullies, and you have to at least declare that you will not kowtow to them. You cannot negotiate with them. And that is the beginnings of any sort of principled resistance and any sort of principled differentiation with the Democratic Party. I also do think the Democrats, we're going to have to adopt some non-conservative ideals in the future to remain competitive, because Trumpism is a virus that will not entirely leave. I think the Republican Party is going to become anti-trade, just to name one thing, and then I'll stop here. The Republican Party is going to become very anti-trade in the near future, and I think Trump is going to play a huge role in that. He didn't create it, but he brought it into the forefront.
You say, so you're saying you think the party as a whole is going to become anti-trade?
I think that candidates, national candidates, and especially candidates in northern Rust Belt areas will no longer be able to get away with the, well, I like free trade and I favor free trade agreements, the game that everyone plays where they vote one way, they say one thing. This, I think you're going to get a much more full-throated anti-NAFTA, anti-free trade, anti-TPP, or any other negotiated trade agreements of the like approach, because the kinds of people who are opposed to that are the kinds of people who are now more and more becoming the base voters that Republicans are dependent upon. And we, I think, Republican Party elites, for many reasons, many of them good, some of them bad, kind of just sort of took those votes for granted and ignored their desires and managed to play a game where they said, oh, well, we stand for your values, and then promote free trade, which I think is a good thing. But I think that era may be coming to an end. I think that there may actually be, ironically, the one area of bipartisan consensus that may be coming up is protectionism, which is a very gross thing. And I know if our friend Scott Linsikin were here, he would be pulling his hair out, because this is right. Exactly the thing that he foretold many years ago.
Well, and that's the issue that I have is, you know, it's like if they fall into that trap, instead of refocusing it elsewhere, a piece that I wrote in National Review said, you know, you got to go with what, you know, what Marco Rubio was talking about, you know, address the skills gap, you know, be honest with people and say, look, the factory line job for the most part is gone and you have to do something else. And, you know, I think the Republican Party reaches out to people and says, look, there are plenty of jobs out there. I mean, the job openings in the United States are the highest they've been in 20 years, like 3 million available jobs out there.
But nobody's trained to fill them because right. They don't take those.
And listen, as valid a point as you guys are making, these people don't care. They don't care that there are jobs out there. All they care about is that they finally have someone telling them who they can blame for their lot in life. And they're going to take this opportunity to stick it to those people, intellectuals, cultural elites, the people shipping your job overseas, whoever it is. It's textbook. This has happened before in other countries. It's happened in this country before. And it works because the people are the ones who hold these ideals. The argument could be made, and I think it should be made, that Trump has activated these people. It's not that they have fallen into error. This is what they always thought and what they always believed, and it was always illegitimate and wrong and hateful, and Trump has just activated those people. Now, unsurprisingly, I have a much darker view of the situation than either Jeff or Jay combined. The thing is, where do you go? Where do you go from that? Where does the Republican Party go from that? And I maintain that they will either completely repudiate this belief system.
It's got to be one or the other. It's got, yeah. Okay,
or they will embrace it. They right. will double down on it, just as Trump has. And I have to think.
Given, I disagree. I think they're going to try the modified limited hangout.
They'll try it. But think about this, Jeff. When the Republican Party, the moderates who don't reflect Trumpism, are defeated in their primaries or what have you over the next couple years, when that happens, then the hostile takeover of the Republican Party will be advanced. They've got a foothold now. They're pressuring people like Paul Ryan, putting intense pressure on the RNC. They've essentially hijacked the whole system. So where does it go from there? They just consolidate their gains and they take over large parts of the Republican Party apparatus. Eventually, more and more of the leadership will come to reflect their views just by the simple fact of attrition, and that's who's going to get voted in. So think about it.
But what happens next week when Paul Ryan beats Paul Nealon easily?
Nothing happens. It doesn't reverse anything. It doesn't change anything about the trajectory of this. It'll happen eventually. Paul Ryan will retire, or he will become unpopular, or his caucus will become so full of Trump people that he'll be John Boehnert. It'll happen. And I have to say this as well. Paul Ryan is a compromised individual at this point. Anytime he tries to speak with any sort of moral authority in the future, I will remember that he endorsed Donald Trump. There will be the specter of Trump haunting him whenever he tries to speak to decent people. That is going to follow him.
Neil, I have to ask you now, and I know I'm trolling you when I ask this, but how will you then feel about, say, Ted Cruz, who didn't endorse Donald Trump and very pointedly failed to do so?
Oh, you mean the Ted Cruz who took back his endorsement of Donald Trump from last summer?
I knew that was where you were going to go.
Yeah, see, Ted Cruz was too clever by half. He thought he could play the game and court these racists and anti-Semites and bigots and protectionists and swipe them from Mr. Trump. But they just decided, why go for Trump Lite when I can have Trump Classic? Okay? Ted Cruz is a fool. Ted Cruz is more responsible for Donald Trump than just about anybody else
in
this presidential race. No. I definitely think that the American people are more to blame than Ted Cruz. This couldn't have happened if people didn't vote for Donald Trump.
No, I agree. But at the same time, now you have people like Marco Rubio, who was tweeting with the hashtag Never Trump. Now giving us the, you know, we have to go with Trump because he's not as bad. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of the not as bad. It's kind of like, I told people, I said, it's like choosing Dennis Rader I just lost track of his name, the Florida one, the serial, Ted Bundy, because he killed less people. He's a better guy because he didn't kill as many people as Ted Bundy did. That's basically what you're saying. In that, you know, I'm going to choose Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. You know, I mean, I'm a lot more optimistic than Neil. I happen to think that if Trump loses in grand fashion as he does, then I do think there is going to be a complete repudiation of those people. It all depends. I mean, if it's close, then forget it. And if Trump wins, then I think I keep talking about opening that fishing charter boat business in Costa Rica.
But let me just counter by saying this, Jay. the people who boosted Trump, how many votes did he get in the primary? 13 million?
Something like that. 43%.
Let's assume that 99% of 13 million people are just bandwagoners. They saw which way it was going, or they thought Trump was funny, or what have you. But let's say 1% of his support, 1% of 13 million people, are active, dedicated, mobilized, committed fascists. Okay? They don't just disappear after this election. They've had a taste of political influence and power now. You think they're just going to vanish back under their rock?
No. Will they find a vessel as canny in his carnivalesque ability to split a divided primary field?
Maybe
as
they'll
Donald
get
Trump
maybe
was.
They'll get smart and they'll nominate someone like a Richard Spencer, who has a hipster haircut and wears blue blazers and happens to be the head of a white supremacist think tank that gets invited to give talks at places like the National Press Club in D.C.
Right.
Maybe they'll get a little bit more savvy. They'll polish up their approach. That's what happens. That's what's going to happen. And I don't feel good about it, guys. Not at all.
I have to say, I'm a little more sanguine about the future of the American polity, even the conservative polity, than Neil is. But of course, that comes with sort of an associated depression, because I think that these fascists aren't going to wise up. They're not organized. They're not going to get themselves into a position where they can, you know, actually mount another serious challenge. But on the other hand, one of the main reasons for that is that this country is going to be moving irrevocably to the left. And so it's, you know, death by drowning versus death by fire. So
you don't think that that leads to an increased potential for actual violence?
Violence, sure.
Threats,
yeah, no,
intimidation.
Sure, all of that, fine. But the actual destruction of civil order in the United States... I don't know. We would be getting into a very, very extreme position if there was an actual breakdown of civic order, and I don't think it would happen.
Is it inconceivable? Has it never happened in history?
It's never happened. It certainly happened, rather, in history, but I don't think it would happen in modern history. And I'm not a Whig historian here. I'm not just saying, oh, progress has made this impossible. I think there are certain actual cultural, technological, civilizational factors that make it rather improbable. You can't rule it out. I don't want to just simply dismiss it. I've been so wrong about so many things at this point that it would be folly for me to do so. But no, I don't think so. I think actually the most likely outcome of this whole mess is the country shifts to the left, which is, you know, no comfort in any way, but it, to me, strikes me as the more likely outcome. And I think a lot of people acquiesce to it at the same time. Because remember, a lot of this is generational. Older generations die out, younger generations come up with new values. And that would be the key determinant in this case.
Right. And that's where, you know, I mean, that's where I think, you know, I agree with what, like I said, a little bit more of an optimist. Yuval Levin.
We're all just on death, destruction, doom, and gloom here today. Can't wait to start talking about music.
Well, again, Yuval Levin wrote something called The Next Conservative Movement. It's a really good essay in the Wall Street Journal. It's actually taken from his book, A Fractured Republic, where he basically says that Donald Trump is the end of an era. That Donald Trump represents the last gasp of the Reagan Democrat boomer generation that, you know, has been used to a certain way of life where, you know, you can just be whatever and get a 9-to-5 job and make a living and raise a family and all that other kind of stuff. And things have changed. And so, I mean, that's where you see all this nonsense about, you know, all this nonsense about trade and, you know, if they could just sit there and blame China, you know, for what's going on.
But you see why the divorce is going to be so painful if that's true, because what Yuval Levin is saying essentially is that, well, this is the death of the American dream, broadly understood. The get a 9-to-5 job at the factory, You know, you just work a normal manufacturing job. You can have a house, a wife, 2-3 kids. You get taken care of in your old age. Life is good. This is the sort of norm from the post-war era all the way into the 90s. And what we're saying here, and I think he may well be right, is that, oh, well, you know, globalization, trade has changed all that. The economy's gone to hell. All sorts of government budgetary issues. That is going to be, you know, there are bad divorces and then there are agonizing divorces. And that will be a dream that people do not want to give up on easily. Even young people, for that matter. Although I think, you know, people of my generation and younger have sort of adjusted themselves psychologically somewhat to that. That's why this is going to be hard.
Jay. Right. But that's where it comes back to what Neil was saying, is that, you know, these people are just, they're looking for someone to blame. And they found someone in the quote unquote politics. I mean, let's face it. I mean, listen here. I'm going to play this little video. Just you listen to the audio. This is some goober that's sitting there yelling at Ted Cruz. And then listen for the guy in the background. You'll hear him. Some redneck screams out in the background. Listen.
Once again, Lion Ted.
Well, okay, Lion Ted.
No one wants to hear career politicians have killed America.
You are the problem, politician.
Can I ask you something? Out of all of the candidates, you like rich people who buy politicians.
Where's your Goldman Sachs jacket at? We know your wife works there.
So, you know, the guy says, where's your Goldman Sachs jacket? We know your wife works there. Like he just discovered the lost city of Atlantis. You know, everybody knows. Everybody knows that you know, Ted Cruz's wife works it there. But you hear the guy screaming in the background, politicians have ruined America. And so it goes back to what Neil was saying, is that these people are just looking for somebody to blame. That it doesn't necessarily, I don't even think they care if there's any solutions.
They have been nurtured in this stew of resentment and hate for decades. Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, Ted Cruz.
You're choosing the wrong people.
I'm not, because it's all part and parcel.
No.
It's all part and parcel of trading on this resentment, this feeling that you're not getting what you're owed, and we know who's to blame. Whether it's your garden variety Democrats or whether it's Mexicans or the Chinese, someone is responsible for your lot in life. And let me tell you, Buster, I've got the answer right here. It's simple. All you have to do is vote my way, and we'll take care of those sons of bitches. That's what they're selling, and that is a message that has resonated throughout human history. We are no less susceptible to it than they were in Athens.
But it's Rome. It's still just funny how it's a billionaire who has never given a rat's ass.
It's always been about the working person. Back in ancient Rome, Pulcher, he was very rich. Crassus, very rich. These people are demagogues. They are dictators in training. Caesar, extraordinarily rich.
Who was Alcibiades in Athens? He was a rich son of rich people who just sort of entered into politics because it was his birthright. Exactly.
And what they do is they manipulate the masses by placing themselves on their side. They say, I'm one of you, even though I was born from wealth, blah, blah, blah. I see your value and I will stand for you. All you have to do is vote for me. Empower me. Put me in power. That's what Donald Trump is doing. It's textbook. We've seen it throughout human history and we know how it goes. People love it. People desire it. That's what we're seeing in the Republican Party, and that's where we're headed in the Republican Party.
Well, now that everybody is sufficiently depressed and everyone's ready, who's been listening for the last 2 minutes is ready to kill themselves.
Ah, or me.
Or Neil, one or the other.
Me too.
I think maybe it's time we switch topics here to something a little less depressing. Though music is something that can always be depressing as well. You know.
Believe me, you'll be depressed when you hear what I recommend.
Yeah, of course. Well, everybody is. Here you recommend, but instead of talking about what you recommend or anything like that, we'll look at it from a different perspective. And you know, we did this with an episode with Billy Newton. We talked about art, and so music is instead of talking about specific bands or specific performers or singers or anything like that, Jeff, let's ask first, like, you love music, you know, you love to talk about it. You know, yeah. I still am amazed that sometimes when you sit there, like when you say, I have this collection of this and I'm making it available, DM me and I'll give you the link, you know? And so you have all this music, you have all this stuff. What, you know, growing up, like, what was it that turned you onto music that it became such an important part of your life?
Okay. You know, that's actually a great question. When I was really young, I always sang. I just, you know, I was a bit of an OCD kid, and I always thought to myself, oh, I'm a really good singer, and I would sing. You know, my parents would take, you know, those home videos of me singing, you know, and doing the school plays and all that, and then I once watched them when I was maybe in, you know, my freshman year of college. They brought them out, and it was the most embarrassing thing in the world. But years of doing that, and my mom had me take piano lessons starting when I was 4 years old. It just became an understanding of a way to express myself. But the actual truth is that I didn't really become like a hardcore music fan until I was in high school. Prior to that, my dad had always exposed me to things. He loved music himself. He's not a musical guy, but he always played stuff for me. You know, he said, hey, this guy Bob Dylan, you got to check this out, the Beatles and all that. Then I finally found that it was a means of self-expression, and then I started relating to it on an emotional and an intellectual level. It became just something that I could, a world that could become something of my own, and a place that I could actually, you know, participate in myself, because I am a musician, I'm a vocalist, I'm a pianist, I'm a guitarist, I can do those things. It's not quite like saying really liking gymnastics or even baseball. I'm a huge baseball fan, but I'm not a baseball player. There is no chance in the world that I could get up there and hit a home run, all right? But I can get up there and play a song, any song pretty much, in the same way that a lot of other people do it. And that participatory aspect has to have been a key thing in sort of helping me become invested and obsessed in it. And it ended up being, you know, it's not the only sort of hobby I have in my life. The only thing that sort of gives me pleasure aside from my job and my family and my wife and all that. But it is the primary one. And it was actually one of those things that it was a primary, you know, thing that I had to make sure I was compatible with when I met my wife. When we first started dating, it was almost like I devised a series of tests where I was like, here's this obscure band. What do you think of them? She didn't have to love them. I was going to be more, you know, allowed, because she's already wonderful. So this is like the last hurdle for her to cross. I was just like, just don't dismiss them outright. Just don't dismiss them outright. Just don't dismiss them outright. And she passed with flying colors. She's wonderful. But like, that's how important it was to me. It became that important a part of my identity.
Well, you know, I have similar memories. You know, my mother specifically was, you know, a child of the 60s. So it's like, when I was 6 years old, I used to come home from school and, you know, I'd like listening to music. And so the only music I listened to was the music that she had was on records, you know. So it was, I grew up listening to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. And of course, and Bob Dylan and everything as well. The Beatles were huge. The Rolling Stones were huge. You know, it's funny. My mother wasn't a big fan of Led Zeppelin, so I didn't like get into Led Zeppelin until like later on when I was in school and my friends were listening to Led Zeppelin. So she didn't like them.
But
what's that?
No great loss.
No, well, you know, they said it was one of those things that was just her thing. You know, she didn't like Pink Floyd that much. She had that one era and those specific, you know, musicians that she was really attracted to. The Beatles were were the big thing. She saw them at Shea Stadium. I remember asking her about it. I was like, what was it like? She goes, well, we couldn't hear anything because everyone was screaming and you couldn't hear him playing. So she went to go see the Beatles and Shea Stadium. She couldn't hear a thing. You know, interestingly enough, I was always fascinated with the drums. And it was Elton John and the song Someone Saved My Life Tonight that I heard. When I first heard it, I was like, holy crap. Listen to that sound that he's making. I didn't, you know, I heard the tambourine and I didn't know exactly how that was done. I'm like, how are they doing that? You know, and of course, you know, I didn't, you know, you see the little hi-hat thing now, they're able to do it. But, you know, that was six. And I learned to play the drums like 28 years later. You know, at the age of 34, I fulfilled the dream of learning how to play the drums. So it happened and I still listen to it. Now, I am a fan of music. I am not like a Jeff fan of music, meaning that I know what I like when I hear it, and if I do, I'll buy it and I'll listen to it and play it over and over again. But I'm not one that goes, I'm afraid to go exploring. Like, I won't go to the record store. There's a great record store here in Atlanta called Fantasyland Records. They've got a ton of vinyl. But if I haven't heard it before, I'm not the type that can just pick it up and buy it and say, let me see if I like this. Whereas, Jeff, you might be somebody who would do something like that, would sit there and take a chance and say, okay, let's just see how these people are. And it could turn out to be fantastic. But
it's not just that, but I'd actually argue that, you know, I have a bit, and this isn't just, you know, rhetorical. I have an obsessive compulsive thing. So, like, the being a completist and getting everything and sort of diving into everything, this helps me a lot in my professional career, helps me a lot in my interests, but it absolutely affects the way I approach music, too. Because I'm just like, I want the obscure stuff. I want the discographical rarities. I want to go see what the side project is. And yeah, take chances too. You're absolutely right. But it's all about a cast of mind, really.
Right. Neil, what about you?
Well, you know, I've got kind of a different perspective. You know, I enjoy music for what it is. It's pleasant sounds, and they do elicit emotional reactions and that sort of thing. I can communicate a certain language, I guess, but I've never really gotten too wrapped up in any one form of music. Never really developed much of an overriding enthusiasm for any. Like, I have certain genres that I gravitate toward, but I essentially treat music as background noise, pleasant background noise, and I don't actively listen to it, which to me sometimes feels like something of an impoverished condition, especially when I see what sort of enjoyment it brings to other people. You know, the depth and richness of human experience, all that stuff. So yeah, it's one of those things where I have very broad musical tastes, but not very deep musical tastes.
This reminds me of a tweet you made years, Jai, must be a year and a half ago, that I've always remembered and loved. And I think it was about sports. You said, I know now why you people talk about sports, but it is something that I can never do. It's like the end of Terminator 2, and it says, lower self into molten lava, thumbs
that was,
up.
That was right back when GIFs were first allowed on Twitter, and I got them lowered into the molten lava.
It conveys the same basic idea. Like, I feel like I'm a robot who's missing something.
I do, though. But I mean, because obviously I have emotions, and I get worked up about things. I mean, the first half of this show was just me getting intensely emotional. But I don't do the same thing with music, and I never have. But you know, I think like a lot of people, I enjoy the music that was popular when I was a teenager, when I was a youth. And I think a lot of people return to that music throughout their lives. It's why Jay likes Frank Sinatra, for instance, because Frank Sinatra was at the height of his career when Jay was in his 20s.
I mean, the 1940s and 50s were just a great.
They were. I mean, you had that post-war boom going on. You had Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. So that's why Jay likes them. But no, I'm just kidding. That's not why. They have timeless appeal, right? Yeah, so I like the Offspring. This is gonna, you know, sound so weird, but I like thrash metal, like Metallica and that sort of thing.
Good music.
It is, but it's very. A lot of the music that I listened to as a teenager, I find unlistenable now. Like Korn is terrible. Any kind of new metal, screamo, all that stuff. I have
Limp
outgrown
Bizkit.
That. Yeah, Limp Bizkit, for instance, it's just so adolescent and immature. But there's something about a band like Metallica, for instance, that has, I should say, adult themes, perhaps, that I can still enjoy. And their composition is actually, I can appreciate the composition of their music.
I mean, it's no accident that nobody's talking about Puddle of Mud anymore, but people still care about Metallica's discography. You know,
I still, to this day, have still not spent a dime on anything Metallica related ever since the Napster incident.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you were really offended by that?
I was.
Laughed and kept on illegally downloading.
you're getting the patches and just going back in and.
You know, I'm making a joke there, but I literally physically own at least, geez, at this point, 20,000 CDs. I stopped buying them at a certain point and just sort of focused on concerts because I just realized I have too much. I buy maybe like 2 CDs a year now, which is weird, but I get to know people through other forums. If the music is really good, modern music is kind of, in my mind, a bit of a black hole. But yeah, like I was even I, who spent all of his hard-earned money throughout the 90s and the 2000s on music, felt contempt for Metallica for that Napster lawsuit.
Yeah, and I mean, I was like, you know, I saw them in concert. I saw that when they opened up for Ozzy Osbourne. You know, I saw them back in 1986 or 85 when Master of Puppets just came out. And I saw them a couple times, you know, so that it was just like, and I had all, I think I had, you know, again, it was cassettes at the time in the 80s. So I think I bought like their cassettes. Like, I had to buy them like more than once because they just got warped or whatever. And they just didn't play right anymore. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, you know, I'm getting their music, but I, you know, I've already owned this. And then all of a sudden you try and log into Napster and they did this thing where they were blocking everybody. And of course the hackers were just kind of like, oh yeah, here, just run right. This and you'll be back in again. And,
well, you know, the interesting thing is the journey of a music snob. Now, I don't know if either of you guys are as, or ever were at least, as uniquely concerned about your reputation among other music snobs and music lovers as I was for once.
No, but never.
Exactly. And I know, Jay, you seem to be like a reasonably non-damaged human being, so you probably didn't have this problem either.
No.
But like, I grew up and I listened to like, oh man, the stuff that I listened to in the 80s, I liked Madonna. I liked, you know, boy, I really loved this band called Genesis, you know, like these great songs like No Reply at All and Invisible Touch and stuff like that. And then once I suddenly got into high school and discovered the Beatles and Bob Dylan and The Who and all that, I was like mortified that I would have ever listened to that garbage back then. So I spent years like a closeted gay man in denial about my true desires. Genesis is truly my favorite band of all time, actually, of everything I've owned and listened to, which is a lot. And I love all sorts of things, very bizarre genres. Genesis, still my favorite group of all time. It took me like 5 years to admit to myself that, yeah, okay, they may not be cool, but they're great.
They're a great
and then
band.
They come out in public. This is the thing that a musical hipster has to deal with. The rest of normal people never even give a second thought.
Yeah, you see, that's like somebody said, "Oh, do you like Genesis?" Yeah, Genesis is great, you know. But I guess you were probably like.
And yet, every time I say I like Genesis, some people start quoting back American Psycho to me, and it just makes me blanch every time.
Oh,
they do it.
God, yeah. If you say that Huey Lewis in the News or something like that, yeah, it's always that's always going to be something that people start talking about, but.
But that's the point, is that people relate to this on like an intensely personal level. You construct, not you guys maybe, and maybe not everyone, but certainly me and a lot of other people I know, you construct an identity around it. And it takes time to sort of let go of that, to just realize, you know what, I like what I like, and that's all I care about.
Right. Well, here's something. I'll ask Neil first. Is there anything that you like that would you might consider a guilty pleasure, something that other people might snicker at? I mean, let's face it, if somebody sit there and said, you know, I really kind of like Nickelback, you know, people would be like, you'd be laughed at. But I mean, so what? Is there any band or musician or anything where you say most people would laugh at the prospect of you saying, yeah, I really like them, but you listen to them anyway?
There are. It's difficult to really think of them. Some of the pop stars that are out right now, I enjoy Taylor Swift's music. I think it's fun. I think it's enjoyable and singable. Still some of the emo bands from the 90s I can get into, like Jimmy Eat World or something like that. Just these really emotionally driven things, you know.
Actually,
I know a lot of people did, and they, you know, they hold up. some techno and synthwave kind of stuff. I think is kind of off the wall and like a little bit weird. But really, yeah. Oh, I know what my guilty pleasure is. Dolly Parton, singing "I Will Always Love You." I am a partisan when it comes to Dolly Parton. And
dude, don't feel guilty about
it. I don't feel guilty about it.
That's a great damn song and a great performance.
I'm proud, but no, my point is that the Whitney Houston version is terrible. And if you say that out loud, people gasp, especially big time Whitney fans. Whitney was a great singer in her own right, but yeah, all wrong for that song.
Do you know who wanted to record that song?
Who?
No, who?
Elvis.
Really?
I can see Elvis. I can see Elvis bringing the emotional vulnerability to that song that is necessary.
Like
Whitney Houston, so big and bold and brassy, and you could tell like she's going to be just fine.
Well, the
reason she's sad right now, but when Dolly Parton sings that song, you know she's not going to be okay. She's going to be crushed emotionally. She's going to go home and probably down a bottle of pills.
Well,
and
before we get too depressed again here.
No, that's what I like to hear in my music. Okay. That brings me
you like
brings
to hear
me
that.
Joy.
Well, anyway, just very quick. Hold on.
Like Radiohead, emotional catharsis.
Hold on, Elvis.
Yes, exactly.
Hold on, Elvis did not record the song. Just a little story, and she told this. This was an episode of Sonic Highways that Foo Fighters had done their HBO series. When they recorded in Nashville.
There's a guilty pleasure there.
Oh, please. Dolly told a story. They said that Elvis wanted to record it, but one condition that Elvis always had, and who was his manager?
Colonel Tom Parker.
Yes. One of their conditions was always that they get a portion of the publishing
songwriting
rights.
Credits, right.
Exactly. Yeah. And she said no.
No.
She said no to Elvis. I mean, that's kick ass right there, man.
I mean, and good for her because that's a song you don't want to give away.
No,
you know?
Well, she said even at the time, the majority of the money that she was making was coming from her publishing, from the writing, not so much from her performing. Anybody who knows enough about business knows that's where the big bucks is the songwriting, not so much the singing. You know, all those doo-wop bands and everything like that in the 50s and 60s got ripped off when the record, you know, their producers kind of stuck their name in on the writing credits and wound up making a mint off that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, Jeff, what about you? Any kind of guilty pleasure, something that somebody might snicker at if you say, yeah, I really like that?
Well, I mean, aside from, you know, I just already had my little Creator over Genesis, but the other one would be, well, there's two. Okay, first of all, the Monkees are a great effing band, and I am sorry. I don't know. I don't care if their songs, for the most part, were written by people who worked in, you know, gray buildings with no windows. You know, those first five or six Monkees albums are actually legitimately great for the most part, and they actually eventually became a real band. The prejudice against them was largely a countercultural relic of an era that would never be found now. Nobody would ever argue. I mean, if nobody has problems with One Direction these days, so nobody would have ever argued about the Monkees. And in fact, the Monkees kind of created, or were at least the precedent for all of those. Here's another semi-guilty pleasure, because a lot of people who are listening might argue with me on this one. But for years, sort of hipster credibility prevented me from admitting Pearl Jam was, maybe not still is, but at least for a very long time was, one of the greatest bands of the 1990s. Truly a top shelf band. The music they did from Versus all the way to at least Riot Act 2000, just fantastic. These guys are a lot more than just a greatest hits album, and I just let, you know, my nose in the air, hipper than thou, oh, well, Nirvana was good, but Pearl Jam was garbage, kind of snooty pretenses get in the way of that. And it's something I regret because I only came around to them in the last couple of years, and it made me realize what I had intentionally excluded myself from for a long time.
There's a there's a great, if you go, you find it on YouTube. Because if you listen to the song Yellow Ledbetter, you can't understand the goddamn thing that Eddie Vedder is singing. And
it's just a Hendrix pastiche.
I know,
like,
but if you go on Pearl Jam, if you go on YouTube and search for that song, there's a guy who did kind of like a bad lip reading thing, but he wrote out what he thought the lyrics are. It's just hilarious because, you know, it's kind of like the bad lip reading.
I mean, I don't know what he's saying.
Yeah. All right. So mine, you know, I don't know how many people think this, but I mean, it's an old Jersey thing and it's not Bruce. I don't like Bruce at all. I will still crank up Wanted Dead or Alive when Bon Jovi comes on, them, you know, if I hear them.
Get out.
Yep.
Quit your show. That's actually not a lie. Guilty Pleasures.
What's that?
Nah, I actually still don't like him. See, now the rivalries still show up. I still think Bon Jovi is garbage.
No, I still listen. It's, you know, those guys, I mean, I grew up close to them. I mean, you know, John Bon Jovi lived like three towns over from me. So it was that kind of connection. Plus, I think it was one of the first concerts I ever saw. I was like 15 or something, like 14 or whatever. I don't remember what it was. But, yeah, I don't know. And of course, he's a big-time Democrat, which you would think might turn me off to that kind of stuff. And, you know, but, I mean, and that stupid freaking DirecTV commercial or whatever he's doing, I just want to, like, throw something at the television. Because it's like, he's probably worth a half a billion dollars, and he's doing DirecTV ads, jingles.
Well, how do you think he got to be worth half a billion dollars, yeah, my friend? But listen, all I'm going to say is that if I cared about the politics of the musicians that I liked, I would be basically just be able to listen maybe to The Who on every other day, and that's about it.
Well,
I
just wrote something about, you know, with Jason Bourne coming out and everybody saying they're not going to see it because of Matt Damon's views on guns, and I was just like, come on, I wouldn't. There are half the movies I love I wouldn't be able to watch if I was concerned about the politics of the actor. Who, you know, Robert De Niro. Do you think I'm going to stop watching Goodfellas or Godfather 2 because of that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I mean, if you get unnecessarily political in a song, that's when I'll just be like, groan and turn it off. But beyond that, I'm going to set it aside. Or, you know, one of the beautiful things about music, if it's well done, is that regardless of the artist's intentions, and this is kind of it's a bit rapey in an artistic sense, but I can read my own intentions into their music. I can pretend it means something entirely different from what they wanted it to mean. That's actually a very empowering thing to be able to do.
Well, it's like
they may have intended it as a left-wing anthem, but I can turn it into a right-wing manifesto if I spin it the right way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and sometimes the lyrics are hard to understand, so there's always a debate about what the song is about. What was it, the Louie Louie? Is it a sea shanty or is it a song about sex? You know?
Right, so, right. Well, I was just in the car the other day. We were on a road trip, and we were looking up just weird words because my wife and I are kind of nerdy like that, and we came upon the phrase for that. It's a mondegreen when you mishear the lyric of something.
Oh, okay.
It's like when you say, hold me closer, Tony Danza.
or excuse me while I kiss this guy.
Yeah. Or there's a bathroom
douche
on the right.
Exactly.
All right. So we got about, I don't know, maybe about 7 or 8 minutes. Let's do this. Off the top of your head, Jeff.
Yeah.
Three albums that everybody should listen to before they die.
Jeez, wow.
I know, it's a tall order, but come on. It doesn't necessarily have to be the definitive list, but...
Well, I mean, okay, I'm going to just name albums that... My like two favorite albums of all time are probably Quadrophenia by The Who and Selling England by the Pound by Genesis. But a lot of people will have already heard those. So let me just tell you three albums that you might not have heard that you should listen to before you die.
Now the music geek in him gets to come out.
Yes! Yes! Here I come. The Color of Spring by the band Talk Talk. Your life will change after you hear this, and you should then get every album they put out after that. Second, In Rainbows by Radiohead, which is a fantastic album that everybody in listening to this podcast probably should have already purchased because they gave it away for free back in 2008. And finally, I'm going to keep it to more modern stuff. I think everybody should own a copy of Pavement's Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain. This is a 1994 album by a supposedly scruffy indie band whose reputation was that they just couldn't give a fuck. But that's not who they really were. They were actually a very, very careful, cautious crafter of melody and lyrics. And that album is their greatest legacy. and they're basically the greatest band of the 1990s, in my opinion, even better than Radiohead. So those three, that would be mine.
All right. Neil, anything?
Gustav Holst, The Planet Suite, Offspring.
That's not an album. That's a composition.
The London Philharmonic Orchestra's recording of Gustav Holst, The Planet Suite, Jeff. Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Offspring, Smash, and that's the only one that I, that's, those are the only two that I can think of right off the top of my head.
All right. So let's see, my three: Kind of Blue by Miles Davis, one of the, probably the greatest jazz album of all time. I can listen to that over and over and over again. It's amazing.
Yeah. Sure is.
Houses of the Holy by Led Zeppelin, one of their best albums, even though it's not, for some reason, it's not one of their most well-known, but the song, every song on it is just, is kick-ass, except maybe for one. I am not a fan of that.
The crunge. You don't like the crunge.
Exactly. See, look at this. Guy even knows the song that I don't like on the album. Now you're really geeking out, Jeff. But it's good. I like that.
See,
like
this
that.
Is all weird for me because I can't even remember which musicians I like right now. You guys have this in your head.
This is why Jay asked me on this show, because this is, I can just pull it out. That's track five on Houses of the Holy. And it just ends with like, has anybody seen The Bridge?
It's
a terrible song.
It is a terrible song. All right. So something a little bit more modern would be El Camino by the Black Keys. Great album. So there you go. We'll try and I'll try and remember all this, and maybe after the show we'll write it down so we put it in the show notes, and then people can go and listen to that stuff. So
get
all right.
YouTube links up or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to do it. Great show. I must say that I enjoyed the second half a lot more than I enjoyed the first half.
I'm a big shock.
But you know what? It's funny because some people will be like, all right, I'm going to listen to the first half and then I'll turn it off. And others will be like, ah, I'll skip the first half and go right to the music. So there's something for everybody, which I think is kind of cool.
Yes, it is. And in fact, it's a good place to remind our listeners, if they enjoyed either half of the podcast, they should go to iTunes, give us a rating, tell your friends and neighbors to subscribe.
Yeah, subscribe. That's what we love. We love subscriptions. You know,
Neil, I have a question for you. If you would like to go to iTunes and give a good rating, but do not have an iTunes subscription, is it still possible to do so?
100% yes, it is. I'm sure.
No.
Probably.
You actually have to have an iTunes. Now you don't have to have an iTunes account. You do have to have iTunes installed on your computer, though.
No.
Or you have to have it on your phone. And since he doesn't have a smartphone.
I asked this precisely because I wanted to do this a little while back. Oh. And I think maybe the first time I was on the show, the famous missing episode. And they told me I had to install it on my computer. And the one thing no music freaks ever do is install iTunes on their computer.
Oh, well, then in that case, just tell people to do it. Tell other people to
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, there you go. Tweet
tell
out
your
this
mom,
episode
tell
like
your
every
mom and your dad
every hour.
Well, grandma, my wife has iTunes on. My wife has iTunes on her phone. I'll use her account.
Perfect.
All right. Well, Jeff Blair, tell everybody where they can find you.
I primarily with the Decision Desk HQ. That's the best elections website on the internet and probably in the world at this point, I would argue.
And follow Jeff on Twitter at Esoteric CD. He's a really good follow. Has a lot of interesting things to say. And if you ever get if you like linguistics, every once in a while Jeff will just decide I'm going to talk about linguistics. That's what kind of guy Jeff is. He just you never know what's coming at it, what he's going to tweet about in any given moment.
I think the term you meant is nerd, but there you go.
Hey, wait a minute. We have one more thing.
I was going to say, Jay, we have one more crucial piece of business to attend to with Mr. Blair. Here.
Yeah. Well.
Yes.
Well, okay. First of all, now we're not going to do the Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin thing. We know that you like Frank Sinatra better. You've chosen Frank Sinatra. So we've decided on a new question that we've asked, and we actually tested it for the first time last week with Billy Newton. So the question is,
me here. Oh, damn it.
We are. Yeah. This is the only time we ever do a gotcha question for our guests. And it's an old and ancient battle, perhaps an irreconcilable difference between Jay and myself, but also between many factions on the internet. And I think it's something that you will probably be prepared to answer, Jeff.
Fire away, man. I got to take it as it comes here. All right. What is it?
Very good.
All right, so you're going to hear something here. You hear some music. It's from a very famous
action movie. I know Ode to Joy when I hear it.
So the question is, and we're talking about the movie Die Hard, is Die Hard a Christmas movie or not?
And just before you answer, I want you to remember that however you do decide to answer, whether you answer right or wrong, it won't affect our opinion of you as a human being. So which is it? Is it a Christmas movie or not?
It should be.
Wait,
how's that for an answer?
That, I will say, is a no. It is not a Christmas movie.
Okay, in my heart of hearts, it was released in August. But yes, I always think of Christmas when I think of Die Hard. So I have always felt Die Hard was a Christmas movie, but I went back as the, you know, very rational, literal, OCD, research-oriented person I am. I'm an attorney. And I found out it was released in the summer. And I'm like, well, is that a Christmas movie? They may not have intended it as such, but it became a Christmas movie.
Yes or no, that, Jeff? God damn it. Yes or no?
Yes!
Yes!
Damn it! Yes! With all of my heart! Yes!
It is a Christmas movie.
So that's 2-0 for this question.
We're going to have to find a question that you start getting some wins on, Neil. At least a streak.
Man. Matters. Die Hard is Christmassy. Ho, ho, ho. I have a machine gun. Yes, it's a Christmas movie.
It starts off like one of the first songs that's played is a Christmas in Hollis.
Yes, by
Run DMC.
Every time. Incidentals. It's all incidental.
No, and you know, it's funny. It's not incidental because, and I think a good point was brought up last week. Those guys, if this was like Labor Day weekend, everybody still would have been there. The building was only empty. Everybody was kind of gone home and everything because it was Christmas Eve. They could not have pulled that off during any other day of the year.
And I will also point out that Nakatomi Towers was located in Los Angeles. And if it had been located in a reasonable city, a city where actual humans want to live, like, say, Chicago, that there would have been snow everywhere. And that we would have seen snow in the background.
Like they did Die Hard 2.
Snow on the top of the skyscraper during that final showdown with the helicopter and everything. And then we would have thought much more in our minds, this is a winter and therefore a Christmas movie. It's just because it was located in the blasted, desert, arid hellhole that is Los Angeles.
No. See, here, I thought it was because it was a movie primarily about a guy creeping through a skyscraper and shooting terrorists, not Christmas.
But that's the spirit of Christmas, Neil.
Killing terrorists.
Okay. No. He gets the greatest gift of all. He gets his wife back. He gets his family back. Right. That is the Christmas spirit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, that is going to do it for this week. And thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it. Thank you, Neil.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.